I'd like to welcome everyone to this very special meeting we have on a Friday afternoon. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Isanoglu and his delegation, all of whom are just grabbing their chairs. I literally would say welcome before I turn it over to Dr. John Hamray, the president of CSIS, who's kindly agreed to chair the meeting today. And Dr. Hamray.
Well, thank you all for coming. And please do move in to sit at the table with us. We would like to have your company at the table. I'm delighted to have you here. Professor Isanoglu, welcome. This is my first chance to meet you. And when I saw such a prestigious person, background, and responsibilities, I thought I needed to bring in reinforcements. And so I appealed to a much higher authority. I would like to introduce to everyone Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. Cardinal McCarrick is the Archbishop Emeritus here in the Washington Diocese. And I'm also proud to say, as you'll see on my board, he's on my board of trustees. And I reached out to ask Cardinal McCarrick to join the board and to join us today because he had a much larger responsibility on behalf of the American Council of Bishops, but also, I would say, more largely for the Holy Father John Paul to be an emissary around the world on very sensitive matters of political and religious significance. And I think it was in that regard that he met you. And when he learned that it was an opportunity to come, he just came off of a trip, and I found out he has slept in his own bed only two nights during the last 4 months, and so this is a special sacrifice on his part. So I'd welcome both of you, and Father McCarrick, thank you for joining us. I would just like to say to our guests, you're coming at a time when America is going through a gigantic period of introspection. We are trying to figure out the proper role of religion in American politics. And it is debated. It's hotly debated. And there's division in the country with no clear directions on where it's to go. I suspect that this is not unlike the debates that many of you are encountering. You know, this is one of the challenges of modern society. So I think this is an opportunity to hear you as you're thinking your way through this. We welcome it. We hope that it could be a start of a longer-term pattern of dialogue, which we think would be valuable. And I certainly would be grateful for the opportunity to continue this discussion. So thank you all for coming, and we look forward to listening to you. Father, do you want to say anything to begin, or before we turn over?
No, just to say how pleased I am to see Dr. Isanoglu again. It has been a long time since we had an opportunity to visit some years ago, but it is a very special treat for me to see him again and to know the extraordinary work that he has been doing and to know the fact that those of us who met him years ago and knew his brilliance and his wisdom are now multiplied by so many in the OIC who have chosen him as Secretary General because of that same wisdom and that same brilliance that he has had all through this. And I think all of us who deal with the great world of Islam are delighted that someone with his background, with his interest, with his prudence, his concern, and his deep faith is in this very important position. So I'm delighted to be here, too.
Please.
Well, first of all, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm really delighted and honored, myself and my colleagues, to be here in this prestigious institution, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm very happy to meet the President for the first time, and then to meet an old friend and whom I cherish his friendship and personality, Cardinal McCarrick. I think we both, when we met, we had less gray hair.
had more hair just
We had more hair and less gray. And I'm really delighted. It was a beautiful surprise for me, and thank you for giving me this pleasure, honor. I think being here is important for me and my colleagues, because we know of the important role your center enjoys in analyzing global trends and policies and advising governments and other institutions. So being here is rather important for us in OIC. OIC, I think I need to introduce OIC, because I understand that OIC, not everybody is well informed about OIC. Even yesterday we were in the University of Georgetown and we had a joint workshop, and I found that people were mainly scholars who are working with the Muslim world, they are not updated on OIC. So OIC stands today as the second intergovernmental organization after UN in above. From the point of view of its membership, we have 57 countries members and 5 observers, Russia being the 5th observer who joined 2 years ago after my becoming Secretary General. 57 countries are, as you would imagine, Arab countries, Central Asian countries, Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Southeastern countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Maldives, Brunei, and many Eastern African, Western African countries, Saharan countries, Albania, and 2 countries from this part of the world, Guyana and Suriname. So it's really a big organization, widespread all over the world and the many continents. I must say also that for the last 2 years I've witnessed that there is application from many other countries to come, either a full member or observer in the organization. So that shows the widening scope of the organization. OIC was established now after 2 years. We'll celebrate the 40th anniversary. In 1969 it was established. And since then it's grown to be an intergovernmental organization with full-fledged subsidiary organs, specialized organs. It had one of the most successful developed banks and some research institutions, the Jurisprudence Academy. I was heading the Research Center for Islamic History, Art, and Culture for almost a quarter of a century when His Eminence the Cardinal visited us years ago with Rabbi Schneier and many other illustrious leaders of opinion and religious figures from this country. But nowadays, OIC is going through a very important reform. The reform which I am trying to induce, trying to perform or to implement, aims to restructure OIC in a way that it to make it an instrument for development of the member countries. Because I do believe that the problem we face in the Muslim world is, to start with, is a problem of development, of lack of development, or being less developed. And all what we are suffering in the Muslim world is because member countries could not succeed in bridging the gap between their own countries and the advanced world. So when I got the chance to the opportunity to make important document or a basic document. I had worked with about 100 scholars from over the world, scientists, political scientists, sociologues, economists, religious figures, experts on science and technology, etc., etc., strategists. How we can make a kind of a 10-year plan of action, that this 10-year plan of action can help these member countries in solving some of their problems and just putting them on the track and make some kind of objectives where we align them with the millennium objectives. I must say that I'm grateful to the King, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, that he gave me this opportunity. And in the 10th, in the summit of Mecca, 25th of, sorry, on December 2005, I submitted this document and it was unanimously agreed. If you are interested, you can have a, you can find it in our website, 10-year plan of action. So there, there's an attempt to what they called in OIC rhetoric, facing the challenges of the 21st century. So it aims to transform the Muslim world, create a meaningful solidarity in action for moderation, modernization, and development. And I use the two words, moderation and modernization, are the keywords of this 10-year plan of action. Then, of course, one important aspect is the religious aspect. Though we are not religious institution as such, of course, but in the Muslim world, the religious element is very important, and that makes a difference. And without understanding this and putting it in its proper dimension, we cannot solve any problem. And many of our problems today, they are taking the shape of religious problems, and they are not. I might come to that later on. Terrorist activities, fanaticism, violence, extreme, they are all taking the name or the guise, they are in disguised in in the mental of religious, but they are not, in at least in my understanding. So, but this is a fact of life, and we have to address this. How to address this? By promoting moderation and tolerance. How you can promote tolerance and moderation if these people who are going to extremism using religious arguments, then you have to fight them with religious arguments and tell them that what you are saying about Islam is not true. And the proof is so and so. So you have to give them the arguments. This is why one of our major reforms was to reform the what we call the Fiqh Academy, the Academy of Jurisprudence, and to make it a vehicle to spread the notions of moderation and tolerance and combat extremism and terrorism. I will give you one good example, not to be very theoretical. 1 month ago, there was this kidnapping of the of Korean hostages in Afghanistan. And I made a statement saying that this is not correct, and this is innocent civilian people. Nobody can kidnap people in the name of religious. This is against that. It has its impact, and then they stopped killing. Then the Koreans were very happy with this statement, which we did on our own. They came to us and said, please make another statement. I said, well, I already made a statement, but they insist. I said, then let's do the next statement, not in my own name, but in the name of this Academy of Islamic Jurisprudence. And I asked the head of this academy to make a religious statement, not political statement. Religious statement, where he enumerated all the verses from the Holy Quran and the traditions of the Prophet which shows very clearly that nobody has the right to abduct people and kill them. Innocent people, whatever the reason they were there, maybe politically that could be challenged. That is a different issue. But religiously, you cannot just go and abduct these people and kill them. This is not allowed. And those who are will do this, they are questionable, and they are really under the jurisdiction of Islamic law as killers, as whatever it is. So this is this example, and then they stopped everything, and at the end of the day, they had to leave these people while it was, it became a political issue and ransom and all these non-religious aspects, let's just put it this way. So this is one aspect of what we're trying to do through moderation. We did the same when we last year gathered the religious leaders of Sunnis and Shia in Iraq, and we made them agree on a document of 10 articles, again specified, built on religious argument that nobody is allowed or nobody can claim that what has been done, killing, kidnapping, distracting others' temples or others' mosques, Muslim, non-Muslim, could be just justified on a religious basis, that all these are against the law, against Islam. This is just one aspect of moderation, what I'm trying to say, that we are working for moderation. And of course, the one other aspect is that to help that peaceful coexistence between different mazhabs. Coming back to the 10-year plan of action, I think one of the most important things that we are trying, we managed to get provision there to establish an independent body on human rights. And we would start working on this. We did not start working on the establishment of this body, independent body on human rights yet, because we are going through the process of changing the charters. The old charter is written in 1971 or two, and it's passé. It's nothing. It does not relate to the today's world. So we are trying to reform that. So we hope that when we finish the charter soon and get it approved by the summit, we start building on establishing human rights body, independent body, which will also deal with the good governance. This is what relates to politics and religious matters in general. But of course, the 10-year plan of actions, the thrust of it is developmental, socio-economic matters, poverty alleviation fund, which established and with a target of $10 billion. Now we are reaching $2 billion, hopefully. We already had about $1.5 billion, and it's getting to $2 billion. Socioeconomic development, in my belief, in my understanding, is the key to solve the problems. And I think if rich countries would spend some money of the money spent for fighting to socioeconomic, it would be better. We can get better results in a shorter time. One of the aspects which we are really interested, and that explains why I was invited to meet Secretary of Health and Humanitarian Services yesterday here in Washington, D.C., is fighting endemic diseases. We've been, since I came, even before we get the 10-year plan of action, I started immediately working on polio, fighting polio with WHO. We have raised funds, we have raised awareness, and we have been fighting the misconceptions about polio vaccination in some countries, and particularly in Nigeria, because there's a school of thought there which is against this for, I don't want to go in details, but they again, they're using religious pretext for doing this, and we are trying to convince them. We managed to increase the number of polio cases. The number of countries where there is a polio cases to now 3 countries. There were more than 7 when I came, now around 3. And we hope that we finish, once we manage this in Nigeria, I think that will be over. The Muslim world will be free of polio. We work with WHO in a close ranks, and now we are developing another plan for malaria, for AIDS and tuberculosis, etc., etc. One of the major targets of this 10-year plan of action is to encourage economic cooperation and increase intertrade among OIC countries. And now there is a kind of some agreements which has been already reached for helping. These mechanisms are created in our development bank. I must say that being myself a student of science, I had interest in scientific research and development, R&T, and I have managed to put for the first time in the 10 plan of action a target to reach certain level of expenditure on science technology. So at least that in the 10 years we get to 1%, because even in my own country, in Turkey, which is perhaps one of the few advanced countries in science technology, it's less than 1%, the R&D. It's around 6 per 1,000, perhaps. But once you get to 1% in 3-4 countries, that will help in improving industry, technology, and raising the level of education, et cetera, et cetera. And then once you do this, your society is more developed. Once your society is more developed, then you have less extremism, you have less violence, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the case, and of course for African countries we are encouraging them to spend more money on education and fight illiteracy. Now if you allow me, I would like to come to the subject which I am here today, or at least I'm here in this city in Georgetown. I'm here to have, we had a meeting yesterday with the University of Georgetown, and I had lecture today at the same university. Yesterday we had a workshop where about at least more than 30 scholars from all American universities, from European universities and NGOs, from parts of our world. We were all joined hands in tackling the issue of Islamophobia, why there is Islamophobia in the West, its roots, manifestations, and ways to remedy this. This is why Islamophobia is an important subject, and really we need to cooperate with everybody. Perhaps your prestigious institute would be one of the institutions which might care for dealing with the phenomena, Mr. Chairman, of the Islamophobia, because I think this is a very dangerous phenomena. It might get us into where we need not to be, from confrontation, etc., etc. Of course, the consequences and repercussions of 9/11 are still alive and not conducive to relax, to tackle things in a rational way, but we have to be rational. The people in the Muslim world and Muslim communities in the West feel that the stereotyping and the treatment was suspicion, insulting activities like cartoons, like others, are indication of the increasing trend of Islamophobia or hatred to Islam, discrimination against Islam, Muslims, defamation of the religion, etc., etc. So this is the ideas on our agenda, but let me, since we are here in a very prestigious thing, American think tank, touch a little bit about American, U.S., U.S. and the Islamic world relation. I think if we look to the history of America with the Muslim world, we find that it was a very cordial history. Americans, they had no imperial, colonial legacy like some European countries. And America had cordial relations with all Muslim countries like the Ottomans, like the Moroccans, and others. America's image until the Second World War was an excellent image. I remember when I was small boy about how America was seen in my generation until I became university student, etc., etc. But this good image started to tarnish because of tense situation in Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, and then the rising influence of Islamic groups in here. This all adds to the tension in the relationship between America and the Muslim world, and I think we have to be open here in this room. Otherwise, we will not be helping each other. So there is a need, there is an urgent need to improve U.S.-Muslim world relations. High time for that, and I think one major issue which really helps to address this issue or to strike the balance is the Middle East conflict, Palestine issue. Now we are aware and we are following with appreciation steps taken by the President and the administration, State Department, in the last few months, and I'm sure you've known of the President's decision to appoint a special envoy to OIC to listen and to understand, as the President made in his statement. We did appreciate that, and we are looking forward that there will be an appointment of high-profile personality, of a personality which knows and understands the Muslim world's issues and which is keen to develop this relation. And we have already announced our readiness to cooperate and to give our support to such a process. And I do think that it is in the supreme interest of OIC and U.S. to develop friendly and cooperative relations. Let me further develop this idea and say that for the next few decades, we will witness a substantial change in the power of balance in the world. And it's not a secret that the United States will face rivals, the emergence of China, India, some Latin American countries, unified and more stronger Europe. These all are potential stakeholders in the power of balance of the world for the next decades. the Muslim world will not be a rival to the United States, for obvious reasons. So there would be a need for strategic relations between the Muslim world and the United States, which should be welcomed by both sides. And I do think if we manage to pave the way for more cordial, more conducive relations, where the foci of problems are reduced, centers of crisis are managed, and then if there's a help of developing these countries, of a help of spreading education, you cannot have democracy in illiterate society. You cannot have democracy in tribal society. You never can get that in tribal society. It's against the nature of things. You cannot build European democracy or Western democracy in society where people cannot read and write, and they are just looking to the chief of the tribe and tell them, go right or left. It won't work. You not need to be a great authority on sociology, on ethnography, ethnology, or anthropology, or whatever, or social sciences, political sciences. I think that is very clear. Just when you look to these societies, you cannot expect. And I don't think any country in the world, including the United States, arrived to this level of democracy in a, just like this. Look what happened. You had civil wars, you had revolutions in Europe, you have dynasties which were toppled down, kings were put on the guillotine, and civil war in England, and etc., etc. We in Turkey, we went through difficult times until we reached today. And we always know that it's not 100% perfect in any country. And I think we can give examples to this imperfectness of whatever we have. This is why I'm saying that if we need to have democracy in the Muslim world, we have to be patient. And we have to help those who are really working for democracy, not only politically. It should be done through helping these countries to overcome the poverty, to overcome the backwardness, to develop their education, to develop their societies, to have more prosperous societies, to increase their per capita income. Without doing this, you get nothing. You get more Bin Laden, you get more Zarqawi, you get more fanatics. You will kill 10 terrorists and they will have 100. You kill 100 and you will get 1,000 under different names. Because the conditions conducive to this, and then because we have also to understand that there's no other ideology left to be used except Islam. No Marxism, no Leninism, no Maoism. Maoism also only there for Tamil Tigers and some others in that part of Asia who are using it as a ideological justification for their political targets. In our part of the world, you cannot use Maoism, you cannot do Islamism, and nationalism now is almost passé. So this is the case. So what I'm saying, if we really want, and we do want, and I think I'm not speaking only as a Turkish intellectual, but I'm speaking as a secretary of OIC, who I know of many intellectuals, and normal people. When normal people see in the TV the way of life in advanced countries, they yearn to look. They want to ameliorate that. I tell you, there is no difference between a Yemeni peasant who's living in the valleys of Zabid and any peasant in this country, in Texas or California, or in my country, or in Sudan. They are all for a good life, education of their children, a good health. And if he's a religious man, he will go to the church, he will go to the synagogue or the mosque or wherever, if he is. So if we can reach that, if we can help this process of development, I think we will all be in a better world. So as I am saying, the Muslim world should be in the next 2-3 decades the strategic ally to the U.S. because the Muslim world population will be almost in these 2-3 decades 1/4 of mankind. 1/4 of mankind, all of them Muslims. So you have very important demographic reason, dimension. And then the where this 1/4 of the population of the humanity is stretching, it's vast geographical and strategic stretch. And I think this is important for the United States security and for its economic interests. Of course, not to forget energy supplies and other potential natural resources. So if I would conclude, I would like to say that the Muslim world bear no hostilities or hate towards the United States. The friction due to the situation in the Middle East has to be removed, and we are encouraged by the last moves in the American policy. Also, the rising superpowers in the near future will induce the U.S. to look for potential friends and allies. And I do believe the Muslim world can be at the top of this list of allies, provided that we solve these problems, we address the issues in a more conducive way. The rising trend of hostility towards Muslims and Islam among the U.S. public is not for the interest of the neither parties. The U.S. image in the eyes of the Muslims of the world will improve with the positive steps such as the recent moves of President Bush. This is some remarks, Mr. Chairman, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, that I not wanted to share with you. But here, as time allows us in this day of Ramadan, with mother engagements and other things for many of us, me, myself, and my colleagues will be happy to answer some questions.
We do have some time. I'm told that you would like to depart around about 3:45, and we do know that this is the beginning of your first day of Ramadan, so we don't want to make it more difficult than it already is. I was saying to Cardinal McCarrick that in the Christian tradition we have the 40 days of fasting in Lent, but we're not quite as observant as you all are, I think. So we're not putting ourselves through the same burdens right now.
We only have 30 days.
Maybe that's why we're not as good at it. We can't tolerate it. Anyway, so we do open it up. Let me just begin, if I may, to respond to your challenge and request, President. I do think we should be working on this question of a rising Islamic phobia, in America. I don't think it's at all out of control, but it's worrying. I'm actually worried about the deteriorating images that we have of each other. Especially I'm worried about how we're seeing each other in Turkey. We're two countries that shared so much during a long period, and over the last 10 years we've allowed new images to enter in that have become dark and worrisome to me. And I think we should confront that. I don't think you solve those problems by nursing them inside your own community. I think they have to be engaged. So I take it as a genuine invitation to reach out and to have a larger dialogue. You've demonstrated today with your presentation a greatness of spirit that we ought to embrace to use it. And if we can, and I won't speak for anyone else, certainly not for Cardinal McCarrick, but we are starting to appreciate the much larger role that the religious impulse plays in societies, and we have to understand that in a positive way. And so I take it as an invitation. I'll follow up with your ambassador. We can see if there are things that we might do with each other, and I want to thank you for opening it up, and I hope that we can make it a genuine dialogue. We should have that. Let me open the table, if I may, to colleagues who would like to pose questions or make observations while we do have. Please do.
Could be a strategic ally to the United States. Given the current state of the relationship, the mutual hostility, I mean, not to use another word, isn't that a little bit too fanciful to actually think that there could be
too
strategic?
What?
Fanciful? To imagine that kind of relationship? A strategic alliance is a big concept. And there are so many things that divide the two worlds, so much hostility. How do you think we could actually get to that position?
Well, I think it's not an easy thing, of course, but the question is there. Does it worth it or not? And I think it's worth it. It is, of course, you need to have a decision about that. If you think it's worth it, then we can cooperate on that. You can do a lot of things. And I think it is in the interest of everybody to have such better understanding, develop relations, try to fight the stereotyping. And, of course, you need to solve the problems. You cannot keep the problems simmering and developing in a bad way, and then you expect improvement. So it needs two for a tango.
That's precisely why I stepped the way I did, because given you referred specifically to the Palestine issue at the very beginning, given the fact that this has been a problem that's not been solved for 60 years, to believe that that could be solved as a prelude to the strategic relationship was the reason why I asked the question the way I did.
Well, I tell you, frankly, if this problem is not solved, there is no peace in the Middle East. And there is no peace in the minds of the Muslim world. We have to be frank about it. This is the major problem in the Muslim world. Because this is historical injustice. And it was injustice elsewhere solved by injustice in this place. This is it. Without solving this, you can have bilateral good relation with this government, with that government, and that will develop. No problem. But to have a good relation with the Muslim world at large, with the nations, with the peoples, that is a different issue. I'm telling you about this aspect. Of course, bilateral relations, my country has an excellent relation with this country. And many, we are here, we have people from Morocco, from Egypt, from Sudan, from Bangladesh, and I don't think any of our countries here, Pakistan, of course, have any problem with the, but it's not the governments. It's the people. If you don't care for that, it's up to you. Then this means we are not solving problems.
If I understood correctly what the Secretary General has mentioned about the strategic relationship, he was talking in the horizon of the 2-3 decades from now. I do not think, or I hope, that the question of Palestine will last that longer. I hope it will be solved. And now we have many indications on the part of the last administrations in America, President Clinton and now, that there are serious efforts in order to finally to find a solution to the problem of Palestine, which is a major bone of contention between Muslims in the world as a whole and the United States and some Western countries. So we're talking about something that will come in the future when you will be facing very strong rivals in China, in United Europe, with many developed industry in Europe that can match or even go more than the American one. And this is what the actual trend now is taking place. So at that time, I think, as the Secretary General has said, you might find, or you might need a big block of one-fourth of humanity like the Muslim world, who has no problem with you at all, and there is no need to be, to be on your side. This is what I wanted to add. Thank you, sir.
To identify yourself so that everyone at the table will know who you are, I think that would be...
Well, Ambassador Saadet Tintayeb, advisor to the Secretary General, and he is a senior Moroccan diplomat.
Yes, please. Sir, thank you.
I'm Mahdi Fathalla from Egypt. I'm the Director General of the Political Department of the OIC.
You could use your
microphone
so we
can
hear you.
My name is Mahdi Fathalla. I'm from Egypt, and I'm the Director General of the Political Department of the OIC. I'm an Egyptian diplomat. So I just wanted to stress on the very important point which the Secretary General raised as a key word or a key point for reestablishing confidence again between the West and the Muslim world on the other side, which is the injustice feeling. We need to recultivate this feeling of justice between the two parts, because this is a real meaning on the ground which is lost now. Because of all these many problems we are faced by in the Muslim world, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Palestine, of course, this is the very all the traditional historical conflict in the Middle East. So this is very important. You know, there is a deep feeling of injustice prevailed in the among the masses in the Muslim world. This injustice, which is coming from the other side, from the West. They have an upper hand, they are more developed, and they have the might of power, and they are using this might of power against us for the sake of maximizing their own interest. And this reflects on a kind of an injustice environment which is prevailed in the whole region. This is a key point. If we want, in a serious manner, to rebuild, to reestablish confidence and to engage the two parts together, otherwise it will be just an exercise of just a rhetoric and a repetition of the same rhetoric with no real result on the ground. Thank you.
I don't believe it's appropriate for me to try to respond, but may I make a comment and observation in this regard? Because I feel this, because I hear it very often in talking with very sophisticated people like you. But I find a parallel here in the United States that we tend to find a great deal of frustration and anger with China, but when I scrape below the surface, a lot of it, frankly, is about America. It's a lot about our anxieties about our education system. It's our anxieties about how we're going to handle retirement program when there are so many workers coming onto the world stage that are paid a fraction of what our workers get paid. It's an anxiety that our politics is frozen in rhetorical standoffs and it's not producing real solutions to answer. A lot of our frustration about China here in America is about us, if we're honest about it. And I would say I'd have to ask the same about this issue of justice, I think, because a lot of it there's a history of injustice, and the West has been involved. There's also, I sense, a lot of transference of frustration about how societies are organized internal that we're not really associated with, but it gets projected as though it's the West that's the cause of it. And this is really a discussion we should take to a deep level to understand, because we should not be the cause of injustice, but we also shouldn't be the excuse for injustice that exists in society. And just I see what we're doing here in this country, blaming China for our problems, I see also in other places around the world. And I would like to someday have a discussion with you about this, because I think it's a very important element that we have to come to grips with. Thank you for opening it up. May I, please.
Salam alaikum. My name is Ayşe Kadayıfçı. I'm from Turkey as well. But I'm an assistant professor at the American University here, and I teach classes on Islamic sources of conflict resolution, Islamic peace paradigms, and we have been developing an Islamic peace curriculum, which we are in cooperation with the Al-Imam University in Saudi Arabia, in Morocco, in Pakistan, we have projects. I'm also the assistant director of an institute called Salam Institute for Peace and Justice. What I wanted to ask you and share with you, I'm very excited to hear about the Fiqh Academy and how the work is, the kind of work they'll be doing on tolerance and education. And we have done some work in the Muslim world trying to identify Muslim peace-building actors, and there are plenty. But because of many of the problems you have mentioned in terms of development and technology, there is not many possibilities for these Muslim peace-building actors, imams or small NGOs or organizations around the Muslim world. What kind of relationship would you envision for your organization to have with these peace builders? And how would you sort of help strengthen building connections between them? Because they're not very well connected. There's very little funding for the kind of work we do. And so I was wondering what kind of future projects or cooperation would you be envisioning? And what is also your relationship between Muslims in the United States as your organization? Thank you.
Well, peace building is one major target of our new charter. And I think with the acceptance of the new charter, we'll be more empowered to participate in such activities. But we've, at least through I took office at the beginning of January 2005, we've been trying to participate in many peace processes, Iraq, Somalia, Darfur. And, of course, for us, the Muslim minorities in Southeast Asia, in Philippines, in Thailand. We became very active in that, and we are cooperating with governments, international organizations, and the like for solving these problems and this conflicts, in these hot conflicts in this area. Meanwhile, we would open for any suggestions for cooperation, and I would like to say that we are very much interested in building relation with the representatives, official representatives of Muslim minorities in the West. We had some meetings with NGOs, and we have started a relationship with them, particularly on the issue of Islamophobia. So maybe that addresses part of your question.
I am Ali Aslan, Washington correspondent of Turkish Daily Zaman newspaper. Welcome. One of your members, Iran, is a topic of discussion in the world. And in this country as well, Iran's nuclear ambitions. And how do you think this conflict can be resolved? What's your vision on that? And also, I wonder if it goes, if this issue, you know, becomes more and more problematic, and in the event of a war against Iran, in the event of a war against Iran, say, for example, U.S. bombardment of suspected nuclear targets, what would your reaction be? And do you think it would be productive? And what would the reaction
be? You think ever a war was productive?
Well, you know, some people suggest that. And how would be the reaction in the Muslim world, and how would it affect your activities? That's right.
Well, I hope that the last thing to happen on this earth is another war in the Middle East. Well, on this issue, we as OIC institutionally, we have a very clear policy and vision. First of all, we are supportive of all countries' right to have peaceful nuclear energy activities. This right is guaranteed by international agreements, conventions, and it's supervised by non-proliferation treaty, which many Muslim countries signed and party to. We are against the proliferation of nuclear energy weapons. We are against that. And I have repeatedly said that we are looking forward for a free world, free from nuclear weapons. We had a very good example. I was just recently visiting Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. And as I discussed the matter with both presidents of the two countries, we are really happy to see that Central Asian countries have the treaty declaring Central Asia as a nuclear-free zone. So I think this is one good example which should be ameliorated, and I'm looking forward to the day that we can have the Middle East, the Muslim world, free of nuclear weapons. We have to work on that. It should not be selective. There should be no double standards, because double standards, they might work for a short period, but on the long run, they don't work, and they are counterproductive. If we can, like the Central Asian countries, you know, Kazakhstan had a big nuclear arsenal because of from the Soviet time, but they agreed to make it free, and they got rid of that. And all other Central Asians joined. We wish to increase this, and they are all OIC member countries. So we wish to increase this and make it come west from Central Asia to come to Iran, Iraq, Israel, of course, and all the rest of the Middle East. I don't think the war is a solution, and I would pray God not to have a second war, because the second war would be a real destructive war. One should not underestimate the Iranian power and Iranian determination to defend themselves. You might like it or dislike it, you might agree or don't agree, but if we are here talking in confidential way, I can say more few things, but if it is a public one, I would suffice with this. I would say it will be the biggest mistake ever taken in the last 50 years if this happens. And it will open the doors of hell, not only in the world, in the Middle East or in the Gulf, but it will be hell for everybody. Who would afford a barrel of oil which goes up to $200? Who would afford not to have the oil of the Gulf going out of Hormuz Straits for so long time? It's more than one third of oil production comes from there. I think it will not solve problem. It will create more problem. The war in Iraq did not solve problem. It created problems. And now nobody knows how to solve these problems. So if we have another war in Iran, it will be more difficult for everybody and will not help anybody. Any solution. I think any decision to have a war there, that would not be wise, and that would be a historical grave mistake.
Cardinal Carrick, let me give you the last word.
I think I would like the Secretary General to know that the vast majority of the people in the United States agree with you 100%. And we all pray that that we will not have a war in Iran. I was in Iran 2 years ago, and with wonderful conversations with some of the Grand Ayatollahs, I'm convinced that there is a great desire not to have war in Iran, and hopefully that desire will be repeated here in our own country. It would be just, as the Secretary said, what a disaster. I think the Middle Eastern question, the Near East question, is one that that you bring up very wisely. I travel a good deal in the Middle East, and even talking to just Christian leaders, they will all say, we will never find peace in the region unless we find peace in Palestine. I think this is we all agree, and we have been in this country trying very hard to persuade the president, to support the president in these new moves that he and Secretary Rice have been trying to accomplish. So we're very much behind there. Just one question: in the church, the Holy Father, having corrected his Regensburg statement, thank God.
You sure?
I think he's fine. I think the appointment of Cardinal Taran to the interreligious dialogue. You know, Cardinal Taran had been the foreign minister and one of the most brilliant of the Vatican diplomats. Having appointed him now to that area shows that the Holy Father really has learned that we really have to be careful what we say. I'm sure that he did not mean this, but I'm convinced he did not. He's just a professor who found a wonderful quote that he said, well, I can use that without realizing that it would be very offensive.
Father, how a professor of theology quotes a worrying commander.
Exactly, exactly.
And does not quote Thomas Aquinas.
That's
he is quoting a Byzantine warrior who's fighting the other infidels, the Turks.
Right.
So how you quote, being a professor of theology, you quote a commander, a military commander, and you don't quote theologian.
Right. I think we probably should have him go and give that talk again, quoting also the theologians, and to yes. and to balance us all. I had one other, but I think now that all of us are saying what you're saying. If we can have in the Muslim community the moderate voices speaking, this I think, and I'm so proud of what you're saying, Excellency, because if the OIC is going to be a voice to try to make the moderate voices in Islam heard, what a great blessing that would be. One quick question. I know your day is so busy. The Amman message, I speak yes. to King Abdullah sometimes, and I think this was a good step forward. Is this what we need to do?
The message of last year.
Yes, yes.
But it was not answered. Mm-hmm. It was not heeded. This message was to His Holiness the Pope after his famous, I still say famous, lecture. And we didn't get any answer for that Amman message.
I'm talking about the original Amman message, where he got a number of the scholars of Islam.
Yes. This is incorporated into our 10-year plan of action.
Wonderful, very good.
This is incorporated in there. Yeah. I'm glad you asked me a question.
And we will work on the other message.
Okay.
Thank you. We've
come to the hour when we've promised our colleagues that they can leave and seek a respite in a long day. It's been a rich discussion. I think it helps remind me of why we need to have an active dialogue with people of faith as well as people of politics, because you cannot get to the deeper meaning of solutions unless you do. And you've helped us today. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you all.